sound is.
And we're back. Nick Athanasiou, welcome back to your living room.
Thanks, mate. It's great to be back.
It's good to see you, mate. And as ever, we have another big show planned, don't we?
We do, mate. It's going to be a massive show. But more importantly, we have a an announcement, I guess. Congratulations are in order again. You and Dimitra, another baby in the family.
We do, mate. We had Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
He's such a good baby as well, mate.
Knock on wood, mate. Knock on wood.
He sleeps, you reckon? He sleeps all through the night.
Don't say that on the show.
He's been feeding well. So, mate, you've got a perfect baby there. What's happened?
You've just told everyone that that's the case. You've just jinxed it. Thanks.
Why?
No, we should be okay. Knock on wood. He's doing really well. Dimitra's doing well, so we're very proud. As much as I love doing the nappy changes and feeding, it's great to be back in the distillery where I can force feed you alcohol. Always good fun.
It is, mate. Thanks for that. And we do need it. It's a cold afternoon, so something to warm us up.
It is. It's been cold in Sydney the last few days. It's been ridiculous. But, you know, as you say, no better excuse to do an episode of this podcast. And true to form, there's alcohol on the table. There's mezze. There's all types of stuff, isn't there? We're ready to go.
We do, mate. We've got some great guests as well.
Absolutely. Well, another huge episode planned, and this one's particularly close to home because we're talking about the Greek diaspora experience both internationally but also in Australia, where we obviously record this podcast. But more specifically, our guests are all about photographing, exhibiting, publishing, and documenting the historical and transnational influences of the Greek diaspora, particularly in regard to the Greek-Australian experience. They've been doing this since 1982, and their diverse archive is recognized as being nationally significant. The photos of one of our guests, Effie Alexakis, is held in both public and private collections in Australia, most significantly in the Australian National Gallery in Canberra, the State Library of New South Wales, and the Australian Embassy in Athens. She's been ranked as one of the leading portrait photographers in Australia, with her work being exhibited across the country in numerous solo and group exhibitions since the 1980s. Leonard Januszewski, meanwhile, has held both the New South Wales Ethnic Affairs Commission Fellowship and the New South Wales History Fellowship, active as an applied sociocultural historian since the early 80s. He's currently a historian and curator with the Macquarie University Art Gallery, where he's responsible for developing an ongoing array of fine art and sociocultural exhibitions. Their work has included numerous national and international touring exhibitions, 4 major books, articles, conference papers, and 3 documentaries, among a host of other things as well. Both have been awarded numerous state, national, and international grants for their research and exhibitions, and have held the positions of research fellows with modern history at Macquarie University. Their new books are Effie Alexakis, 40 Photographs, A Year at a Time, and The Heart of Giving, Father Nectarios' Soup Kitchen, to be released later this year. Mm. So, Nick, that's the short version.
Can you just say that again, Tom?
Hold on. Let me get into it. No.
That was a good effort.
Effie Alexakis and Leonard Januszewski. I did get it right the second time. Welcome to Uzo Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you here, and especially after an introduction like that. I mean, you've done so much great work and continue to do so much great work in the community. It must be very rewarding for you guys.
It's rewarding, but we are in our 60s, so we feel as if, you know, time well spent, I suppose.
But I think he's actually referring to we're physically in our 60s. But mentally, I'm still a 16-year-old.
Right. As you've noticed.
You look like a spring chicken. You're all good.
Oh, thanks very much.
Definitely.
Fighting fit. Well, after all that intro, mate, I have a hard-earned thirst. Should we get into it?
I think so, mate. Let's have a drink.
Let's do it. Yamas.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. See, I've got more Rizzo than everybody.
Welcome.
You do.
Okay, so Nick, what are we drinking? Grab the bottle there.
Well, what are we drinking?
What aren't we drinking is the question, isn't it?
Well, we've already started on the Vekaraki. We're going back to Tsipro. It is a cold afternoon, so how good is it having a Tsipro to warm you up? And we can't get past our Uzo. We've got a mini. Couple of shots of mini happening as well.
Absolutely.
All compliments of Milloway. Our good friends at Milloway are back on board.
That's right. Our drinks come courtesy of our amazing sponsors for this episode in Milloway Allwood Wines. Harry and family, thank you so much for your support, and a belated happy birthday to you, mate. Harry, If you live in Sydney, 285 to 287 Homer Street, Ullwood, to get your hands on all the products from Greece that you need. They're absolutely lovely people. Go and visit Miller Way Ullwood Wines.
Definitely, they certainly are. So get in there, go and slap Harry on the back, wish him a belated happy birthday. Go, Harry, you legend.
That's it. And Nick, would you believe we have a new sponsor joining the Ouzo Talk family, just as everybody is planning their summer getaways to Greece?
We do, mate. And how good is this?
It is, mate. flymenow.com.au. If you're looking to do some traveling, visit flymenow.com.au travel agency to design your dream escape. The team can help you with flight bookings, hotel reservations, car rentals, transfers, cruises, transport, insurance, travel money, corporate travel, and a whole lot more. Felt like the intro there for a second. Take the stress out of your planning and let the team at Fly Me Now sort your next trip for you. It's your one-stop shop for all your travel needs. Head to flymenow.com.au and start booking. And we're just so proud to have those guys on board, aren't we, Nick?
Definitely. Yeah, look, Poppy and the team, thank you for reaching out to us. You guys do an amazing job. She's got amazing discounts, apparently. So yeah, get on board and become a member as well, so you get notified as soon as they come on board. Mm.
Thank you guys for being on board. Thank you to our sponsors for making this podcast possible. Now, to business, though. Your last name, Leonard Yanishevsky, is not a very Greek name, but...
Yes, it is. Yiannopoulos.
Is that what it actually means, you reckon?
No. Yeah, well, yes, it does in many ways. Johnson, yeah.
Yeah.
Son Johnson,
okay?
Yeah.
All right, okay.
So tell us a little bit of where is your family actually from?
Well, I'm more of a mixed business than you guys are, okay? My background is German, Polish, Ukrainian, Maltese, and a bit of Italian, possibly a bit of Swedish too.
Yeah, right.
So I'm quite a mix. But I'm a product of the post-war migration boom. It's the only way that my mother, who was Maltese, would have met my father, right, who was a Polish-German origin. Mm. They met out here after the war because of the migration policy that Australia had. And I've got one brother and one sister, and we're all quite happy with our background being as mixed as what it is, because it gives you a broad vision of the world, sure, particularly when you go into the history of your own family and then the history of the regions that you're from.
Mm. Did they come out in the 50s or the 60s?
Yeah, they came out in the 50s. Father arrived out here as a refugee.
Oh, wow.
He set foot on Australian soil at Woolloomooloo on the 1st of January 1950.
Wow.
He had to migrate. Mm-hmm. He'd basically lost everything. Mm. My mother, on the other hand, from Malta, her family didn't have to migrate, but they did. They all had jobs in Malta, but one particular uncle, Uncle Hector, who was always the life of the party, he decided that he wanted to come out here with his wife, who was my mother's sister, Auntie Mary. And they came out in the early 50s, and then in 1955, the rest of the family decided to come out. And they settled in the suburb of Burwood here in Sydney. And my father had acquired a terrace about five doors down from where they settled. And as I said, Uncle Hector, being the life of the party, saw my father walking past Burwood Pub. Come on in, let's have a talk. He wanted to talk to his neighbours, and then he introduced him to my mother.
Wow.
Well, person who was going to become my mother. And they had a date over at a picture theatre in Burwood. And, well, not long later, I was coming along.
Wow, what a story.
Fantastic, fantastic.
Well, he's to Uncle Hector.
Yeah. Right?
Absolutely.
If it wasn't for Uncle Hector, Uncle Hector.
I wouldn't be here.
And after all that, you had the good sense to marry into the Greek community.
Sorry, could you repeat that? Good sense? Where's that coming from?
Somebody said you saw the light and you married a Greek.
Oh, I did see the light when I met Effie, yes. Yeah.
Well, let me take this question away from you. Effie, how pissed were your parents?
Toxenos! Timos Kanis!
I knew it.
And Effie told me, oh, they loved you straight away.
Yeah. That's what it means.
No. Exactly.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, really, was that actually what it was like, or were they sort of...
Oh, no, they were supportive. If they met him, once you meet people, I mean, it's very different, isn't it? It's if I had said, I want to introduce you to this Australian boy, they would have, been no. But once you meet someone, it becomes more personal, and they've met him, and he's, you can see, he's very funny and
he's
very engaging,
and
talked my parents around, so they loved him.
Yes, and I was only, 20 pounds less? And haven't aged well.
You're looking fabulous. What are you talking about?
Thanks, Effie. I love you too.
Apart from your knees, mate.
Knees. So, Effie, what is your background? Where are your parents from?
Well, my parents were from the village called Sikya. It's in the Peloponnesus, an hour south of Sparti, near to Monombassia.
Beautiful.
They were both from the same village, neighbours in fact. My father came out in 54 as part of the assisted migrant scheme, and after the 2 years of he had to work for the government, then you were entitled to bring a bride. He wrote back to his father and they suggested Maria, who lived next door, my mother, 10 years younger. So she came out, and then I was born a year later.
So by proxy, one of those.
It was proxy, but they actually knew each other. Yeah. So and they knew the family, and they'd grown up. Wow. So
fascinating, you said. So he came out, and he had to work for the government for 2 years.
Yeah, assisted migrant scheme started in the mid-50s, and so advertising everywhere. Australia wanted to build up, so... Mm-hmm. And Greece wanted their young people to have, you know,
an opportunity
to work and succeed. And often they all came with the idea that they were going to go back anyway, didn't they? Like most people, your own family too, probably thought 5 years. And that was something that we always thought growing up, five years, then you'd go back. But once you start having children, you don't go back.
Definitely. Well, like we've had in previous podcasts, Greece in the 1950s was devastated. After World War II and then after the Civil War they had, there was nothing left. So the only opportunity was to migrate.
Well, my father was the oldest of nine. And so after a while, he eventually sponsored six of them, brothers and sisters. And on my mother's side, there were six children. They mostly went to Canada and the US. So sadly, now there's only my mother left here, her brother left in Greece, and one uncle of my father's left here. Everyone else has passed away. So that's really, that's the sad part of
that generation is slowly going, unfortunately.
It seems to be quite fast at the moment.
Can I just ask, so your dad had guaranteed work coming out. What work did he do?
Well, they had to work. First, he was sent to Queensland to do the sugarcane cutting. Mm-hmm. You know, the Australian government thought these were agriculturalists. We can send them off and do the various agricultural work required in Australia. But cane cutting is not something that the Greek in Sikya, they had olives and they had figs and they had, it was a very different sort of work. It was very hard work, you know, and you saw snakes and it was hot and a lot of the men lived together in sheds. So I think he often asked for and they did that too. You couldn't work there for very long. It was very backbreaking and it wasn't what that they were used to. So
so he was there for two years.
At the end of the 2 year time, he was allowed to bring out my mother and then the rest.
And did they stay in Queensland or did you?
No. He first, the migrant camp was at Bonegilla down in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And from there that they all got sent off to various places. The migrant camp was in Bonegilla in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was sent up by train to Queensland with a group of men because they needed workers up in, I think it was called Babinda, up in Queensland. There was a whole lot of sugarcane farms that were owned by Greeks as well back then.
Oh, really?
And so they could request what sort of nationality they wanted, you know, Greeks and Italians. And then at the end of the 2 years, he went to Sydney, settled in Sydney. Our first house was in Redfern.
Okay.
Wrote to his father. My mother came out and I've got this wonderful, a bit sort of poignant, bittersweet photograph of my mother with about 12 men at her wedding reception in this little terrace house in Redfern.
Wow.
And I recently, during COVID, it was an opportunity to go through family photos and ask her about them. And her wedding dress was worn by five other brides after her.
Wow.
And I would love to have traced them, but again, it was something that I, you know, should have thought about 10, 15 years ago when most of the people were still alive.
Yeah.
But and then, you know, what did you eat? Mum had to bake her own dinner for the guests. And it was so hard. And she needed a flower girl. And there was a neighbour, a young girl, that they got to be the flower girl, but wow. She wasn't allowed to stay longer because her parents were worried about all the single Greek men that were in the in the house.
Wow.
So bittersweet stories of early settlement here.
Yeah, it was a common theme because I remember my uncle got married in our living room at my parents' house. That was the reception. So everyone come over, they're all dressed up. So we got old home movies and we're watching them and I thought, that looks familiar. And I thought, shit, that's the living room. So that's a common theme, wasn't it? We didn't have much money, but they made best with what they had.
Well, during COVID, I posted this photo up and George Dukas, do you know the musician George Dukas? Mm. His mother was number two that wore this dress.
Oh, wow.
So that was really special. And
we've mentioned a couple of times already that, you know, that sort of generation is slowly going. Is part of the work that you're doing about capturing that for posterity and being, you know, and really documenting it for future generations? I guess some of it would come down to that.
Well, it's not just this generation. Like, Greeks have been coming here since the early, 1850s for the gold rush. You know, that generation disappeared as well. So I think we've become more emotional here because there's so many more of us and it directly affects us. But it's been happening throughout Greek-Australian history that each generation moves on. One of our earliest interests were looking at descendants of the Greek gold miners, you know, people that are second, third, fourth generation, to talk about what Greek aspects have remained, what has the family kept from their Greek forebear. I always find that fascinating too, because there were certain periods back in the end of the 19th century where you couldn't talk about being Greek. It was frowned upon.
Yeah.
So a lot of things obviously were hidden. But you still have, you know, the name, you still have a few stories that come through. So every generation, I think, has this change. It's a change.
So the 1850s, do we know what part of Greece they came from, where they came to in Australia and anything about them? So who were these people?
Well,
Leonard's
the historian,
Leonard?
So
this
he's
is
better.
Your area.
That's his area.
Come on,
okay,
Leonard.
Look, if I could just start prior to that, it was from the 1810s onwards the Greeks started coming, but these were just gentle ripples. Generally, they were sailors.
Mm-hmm.
Some were convicts, of course, as you're probably aware. They came out here. There was one particular female who was a member of the upper class, and that was Plessa, and then followed later on by Diamantina Roma. And the women came out as dependents upon the men. That was the economic reality.
Did
of
you
the,
say
the time.
Arona? What was the surname?
Roma.
Okay. Yep, Diamantina Roma.
I think she was from Corfu.
Yes, she was.
Yes.
Yeah. Part Venetian, part Greek.
And one of my people.
She was well loved because you've got the Diamantina Falls, you've got the town of Roma.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she was very influential.
And Roma Avenue in Kensington.
Maybe from her too.
It is from her.
So the town Roma in Queensland.
Is named after her, yes.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. Following those gentle ripples, you then had the first real wave, and that was what Effie was referring to, the collective migration of Greeks. From Greece, and possibly migration would be too strong a word. When you had the gold rush here, Australia became the hub of the world.
Mm.
We had people coming from all corners of the globe because of the rushes, and they came here looking for wealth. Now, the Greeks weren't simply coming from Greece. Certainly you had Greeks who were jumping ship, who were sailors on merchant vessels or on naval vessels, and not just simply British naval vessels, all right, or British merchant vessels, vessels of other countries. And they went off to the gold rushes hoping to really make a mozza. Now, some of these Greeks who had come from the United States had experienced, or their forebears had experienced, the 1849 gold rushes there.
Right.
And they knew that, okay, you might strike it rich, but on the other hand, because gold was found in areas which hadn't been settled in terms of European settlement, well, who was going to supply the goods? Who was going to supply the clothing? Who was going to supply the mining material? Who was going to supply the food? And this is where you got Greeks setting up shops.
Mm.
And they would set up shops and sell the miners what they required. Not all of them, of course. Some did become miners. And there was a famous group of miners at Hill End Tambarura in a settlement known as Greek Town. And that was the first collective settlement of Greeks in Australia. There was another one,
wow,
which was established in Victoria, in Maryborough, in a place called Mosquito Flat. Of all names, and they established families. But of course, Greek women were not coming out. Greek women were not part of the initial thrust of Greek migration to Australia in terms of their numbers. And that didn't become so until the 1950s, where you had the bride ships coming out.
Is there a reason for that, why only men came out? Is it because of the hard labour they wanted to do? Or?
It was, look, there are push-pull factors in regard to migration and settlement. Mm-hmm. And one of the main drivers, of course, was economic. Mm-hmm. When you are lucky enough to have a large family, but of course you did have a lot of children who did die young, but if you did have a large family and if you had a lot of girls, it was the responsibility of the males to go out and look for a pirikia. Okay, even in the 19th century, that was their responsibility. You have to feed the family and you have to look for a dowry so we can marry off your sisters.
That was my grandfather.
Yep, okay. Yep. Wow. And so they were coming out en masse to Australia. But it was, look, Greeks have been migrating since the classical period. This is this is part of not simply a tradition, but it's in their DNA to go out. It's not simply adventure, it's also economic need, but also their responsibility within the family, what they had to do. And indeed, if I could move forward, for instance, just a little bit, we also discovered that in the 20th century, Greeks were coming out here in order to find their pirikia. But in later life, even though they had married here and had children here, those sisters who were unmarried in Greece, they felt the responsibility still, and they would leave their family here and go to look after them in Greece. This is before the development of aged care facilities within Greece. Okay? So you had families being split within Australia because that desire to maintain the morale that they were given in terms of their responsibility to go back, they would do that. So you had the push-pull factors of economics pushing them out of Greece, of the desire to go and find pirikias for their families, female members. And of course, they would be pulled by nations that had opportunities for them. And certainly the Gold Rush did provide opportunities for them, both in the United States and within Australia. Now, because within Australia, they had settled on gold fields initially, once the gold started to peter out, what were they going to do? Some went back to their ports of entry and decided, oh, well, let's just see if there's any work here. Some worked on the docks, some became fishermen, some became coastal sailors. Some others remained in the rural areas to become farmers and so on. Others then went into the shops and they established themselves in food catering, which is what they originally were doing on the gold fields. Okay, so they had experience in it. And the reality is that in food catering, you could keep the family together. You could actually stimulate chain migration for others to come out and assist you in that type of work. You didn't have to know a lot of English, but you certainly could establish yourself in the new nation through that particular avenue. So chain migration was really well established during the Gold Rush period. Come out, Australia's a land of opportunity. You can make yourself a small fortune here. But as Effie mentioned earlier, there was also still this idea that eventually I'll go back to Greece. Eventually I'll go back to Greece. And that's another side of the coin to the migration settlement story in Australia. Whilst mainstream Australian historians tend to say, okay, well, look at documents in Great Britain. What I found when I was doing my postgraduate work, very few historians would take a look at countries other than Great Britain in terms of original documentation. And the reality is we still have that type of situation whereby we do not train Australian historians in a language other than English, and our archives are primarily collections of English language material. So we have a cultural myopia still. But having said that, when you go back to Greece, you also find that Greece itself, there were abandoned villages, abandoned towns. So Greece was impacted by the migration, even during the Gold Rush, because you had such a wealth of numbers coming out here. Even though the official census statistics in New South Wales, for instance, there wasn't more than 1,000. No, that's incorrect. Once you start going through and looking at the particulars of individuals who jumped ship or particulars of people who established businesses, you find out that whilst they may have come out here under an Italian passport or under the Ottoman flag, in actual fact, their cultural identity was Greek. And so they're cloaked. They're also cloaked by changing their names, an attempt to, and I don't like using this word, but it's an attempt to assimilate, to establish themselves here by getting a name which was familiar or easy to say off the British Australian tongue. And it was also a way terms of changing their name, of getting up the social ladder and in terms of obtaining work. But during the early part of the 20th century, there were certainly Greek communities that were establishing themselves right around the country, particularly in Melbourne and in Sydney formally. But you also had groups, well, Port Pirie, groups in Queensland. As Effie mentioned, over in Queensland, you did have Greeks in the early part of the 20th century who weren't just simply cutting cane. They actually owned cane fields. During 1925, there was a Ferry Royal Commission into the Greeks within Queensland, and Ferry had indicated that, well, they were useless economically, which wasn't true. They were incredibly well-established, an incredible asset to the economy. It was part of the racist outlook at the time to get rid of Southern Europeans. But that period after chain migration, you had the establishment of communities, as I said, throughout the country, but you still had more men than women. It wasn't until after the 1950s mass migration that you had a effort by the Australian government to get more women here so that men could settle and that they would de-evolve this idea of eventually going back to Greece. Mm.
That is a very comprehensive look at the wow. history, the early history of my Greek migration into this country. I did not expect
no,
any
my
of
God.
That. That's amazing.
I've got a lot of questions now, far out.
He has long sentences too.
Yeah, no, that was fantastic. I could just kept on listening.
Keep know? Going, Leonard.
No, okay.
Why don't you stop? Actually, I was just going to touch on, so you said Hill End, I think 1850s was one of the first sort of Greek populations.
Well, there's a cemetery still there with lots of burials with Greek names. Mm. I can think of now.
So where is Hill End again?
Hill End is near Bathurst. It's probably...
so is that
it's sort
west
of a dirt
of
road,
Sydney?
North-south-west of Sydney, central. Yep. Yeah.
It's about, what, two, three hours?
Not that far.
Okay.
200 k's?
Yeah.
And that's where there was a...
The first
discovered.
Collective settlement. There was quite a few. They had children there. You've heard of the Holtzman Nugget, the largest gold nugget to have ever been found at that time. Anyway, it was stood about, 2 metres, one
wow.
and a half metres tall.
You're
and there were a few Greeks involved with the team that
brought
out this gold nugget.
Wow.
So there were quite a few Greeks working. They worked in groups as well, those that looked for gold. So then they settled, they married... Often the Anglo-Saxon women.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's beautiful names like Vasili Makrianis. If you remember the $10 note, the old $10 note, there's a that's a Greek man holding a pick at the front of with workers behind him. He's
wow.
Greek. Lucky the name Makrianis remained. He didn't anglicise
The name wasn't on the note, was it?
No, no names. But the... Holtzman used a lot of the money that he made from the gold to document.
Makrianis. What does that mean? Short John.
No. Long John.
Long John.
Long John.
Long John.
The opposite.
Cut that out. Long John.
and there's a, you know, we photographed on, the, there's a tombstone, Vasili Makrianis married Matilda. Like, and that's a very Aussie name. So it,
it's like saying John married Sharon.
Sharon.
Yeah.
Sharon. Sharon.
Yeah.
Wow.
Love it.
So... Makrianni and his tribalmen, where were they from in Greece? Do we know what islands or mainland they were from?
We tend to think that he came from Kefalonia.
Okay.
Wow. Many of the islanders were coming out early, particularly during the gold rush period. And the Ionian Islands were responsible for quite a large number of Greeks being on British vessels because they were great seamen. And Britain was
and
a protector.
Protectorate.
From 1815 through to 1864. And, of course, there was a very famous navigation school on Ithaca. And many of those who went there then went across to the defender of the Mediterranean, being Britain at the time.
Okay. Was that Odysseus' school? Or
possibly.
Might have set it up.
They didn't do very well. He took bloody how long to get back home.
And then he had to deal with all those suitors for his wife.
Actually, I reckon that's a funny story, though.
What?
He said he took 10 years to get home and he made up all these stories. Reckon
it was all
that
crap.
Just didn't want to get home.
And of course, you know what
Penelope
said.
You're not going to believe what happened to me. I couldn't get here.
There were these women. And
and I told you just to go and get the milk and look what you did.
Love it. Wow. Okay. So.
So Kefalonian. So and what the main reason was what? Because they were good seafarers.
Yeah, they were good seafarers.
Okay.
They were great seamen. And the Brits recognised that, and that's why they were on their vessels.
Because they would have been under Venetian control around that time, wouldn't they? 1830s?
a British.
British protectorate. Yeah, they were British. The British were protecting them.
And that was the time when Greece were going through independence.
They were attempting independence, yes. And, of course, acquired it in 1821. But, it, of course, it wasn't the Greece that we know today. It was simply Attica and the Peloponnese and the Ionian Islands. There's an interesting story about Kythera. Because of the gold rushes, Kytherians were coming out here, not as large in number as from the 1890s onwards, but from the 1850s there certainly were Kytherians coming out here. And they acquired British citizenship. We didn't have Australian citizenship until 1949. So if you wanted to settle in Australia, you acquire your national... Well, you became an Australian national by becoming a British subject.
Right.
And because of that, during the schism in Greece, during the mid-1910s, between Venizelos and the king, Kythera was actually, well, it jettisoned itself from Greece, and it became, again, a protectorate under Britain because of the lobbying by the Greek gold miners who had gone back, who had become British subjects. I found that fascinating, that they were politically wise in terms of what they wanted to do.
I find it fascinating it's an Ionian island where it's so far away from all the other Ionian islands.
It's an Ionian island politically, but geographically you're quite correct. It's very different.
Well, I can tell you in 1864 in Corfu there was a vote as to whether they were going to stay independent and be part of this, this independent state. I think at that point, the United States of the Ionian Islands, I think it was what it was called. And one of the only villages that voted against joining Greece was mine.
How do you feel about that now?
During the economic crisis, maybe okay. Anyway,
really?
Small digression. Yes.
Story. Wow.
Small digression. But anyway.
Good insight. So you talked about the Greeks owning sugarcane up in Queensland. So were you talking about the 1920s or earlier?
From the 1920s onwards.
And who were these Greeks? What, they just arrived and they
bought
it?
Most of them, I think, they were from Castellorizo. I think in Queensland, a lot of Kazis.
Kazis were coming out. You also had people from Methelini, for instance, who were coming out. And in Queensland, sugarcane farming was very popular. And many Greeks entered the workforce initially as cane cutters and then acquired what they referred to as blocks in Queensland. And this is a significant point because during the 1950s, people considered, oh, well, it's the Italians who are actually running the sugarcane industry up there. Well, I'll contradict that because if you take a look at the original documents, you had the Sugar Cane Cutters Association and the Sugar Cane Growers Association. Greeks were running it,
wow.
Right? And they were the ones who were asking for labourers during the migration process from the 1950s and the 1960s, that they could have them working on their cane fields. They knew the language, they could get on with them, and so they introduced Greeks to the cane fields in the 1950s. But certainly they were cane farm owners from the 1910s, 1920s onwards. But they did other things in Queensland too. They also were tobacco farmers in far northern Queensland, and because of the experiences. This is the wonderful thing about a diasporic people. You have experiences from your country of origin or those countries to which you went prior to coming to Australia, and you apply it and you see what works. So it's transference and then transformation. And certainly the tobacco and the cane industries in Queensland wouldn't have been what they became without an input of knowledge and skill and hard work through the Greeks. They weren't the only ones, but they certainly were there.
Wow. I only ever thought it was the Italians that ran the sugar cane. This is the first I've heard of it now. Any documentation I've read, it did refer to Italians.
You're quite correct there, because the publications that came out during the 1980s, for instance, dealt with the Italians on the cane fields rather than the Greeks. And that then slanted the perspective. But when you go back to the original documentation, you do find that the Greeks were the ones who were the movers and doers to a large extent. And that's not to diminish the Italian input, but the Italian input certainly came later rather than earlier.
Wow. So you're saying we're good immigrants, us Greeks?
Oh, always good immigrants.
Well, look, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. when you take a look at history, you do come across characters with a variety of those traits. And just like any other group, the Greeks did have the whites, the blacks, and the greys, or the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Of course.
But to a large extent, history celebrates those successes. Of course, there were stories about those who weren't as successful, and they become the hidden lives, which we feel have to be revealed. Mm. But the other thing that we try to do in this history that we try to put together is for instance, with the cafe book, people think, oh, you've written a book on the Greek cafes. Oh, I'm sorry. No, in actual fact, that's a book about the interrelationship between peoples through the Greek diaspora, using the Greek lens, because the diaspora, you pick up ideas and experiences. So here we have the Greeks going from Greece to the United States and then coming to Australia, but picking up ideas in the US and applying ideas from Greece into the US, changing the US food culture, and then changing the Australian food culture. Mm-hmm. So it's actually about the transference of ideas. It is actually about Americanization of popular culture within Australia, yeah. Because through food you've got an association with cinema, popular music, architecture, and so on. So it's a bigger history than just saying it's about the Greek cafes, because it's the interrelationship between peoples that are important and how we exchange ideas with one another.
We want to talk about the book, obviously, but before we get to it, you mentioned previously that there's a myopia when it comes to the records and the record keeping, particularly when it comes to the Greek community. As a general rule, how well have those records been kept, and how much do we not know, do you think, when it comes to our history here?
Are you referring to the records that are currently held within the libraries and the archives that deal with Greek Australians?
Yes.
Look, back in 1988, Effie and myself gave a paper over at a conference in Melbourne, and it was the New Responsibilities Conference, where the Hawke government was attempting to diversify our collections. Certainly attempts have been made since then to diversify, and we do have a relationship with the State Library of New South Wales, and we do have a in-principle agreement that they will receive our archives. But to get our archives into a situation about not simply depositing it, but making it accessible, if it's not accessible, it's worthless.
Good point.
We don't have the current financial wherewithal to do that. When you're looking at thousands of interviews, hundreds of thousands of photographs and documents and so on, we just cannot do that. So we don't know how we're going to approach it to give it in a state whereby it can be utilised within the State Library. But the State Library and the National Library are both places which are keen to try and obtain this material, but they have budget restrictions. I tend to think their budgets should be divided differently, but they claim that they have to maintain their current collections. And I can understand that, but we all pay taxes.
And at the expense of this
this
important archive?
Yes.
Like, really?
Yes. Yes.
The problem is too, like, we were in our 20s, we started to try drive around the country documenting it, but it was on cassette tape and it was on film. So there's the added expense of having to digitise everything. Yeah. So I think we were born in the wrong period. that's what collections
do. You would have had good stories back then too.
You could probably fiddle that on a thumb drive now.
Probably. That's the problem. But that's how we discovered a lot of things. We were in our 20s. We decided to drive around the country and see what's there. Where are the Greeks? We drove across the Nullarbor. We went up to Darwin. We met Greeks there. So you've got to go out there and do the research. And this conference that Leonard spoke about, we were very young, we were naive, and we were very critical about, you know, what institutions were doing. They weren't going out there. You can't expect the material to come to you. You've got to go out there to look for it and to put it together.
Well, let's start on that, because how did this relationship start, and what brought you to be able to think this is something that we need to be working on?
Well, I think it was the Gold Rush period that we started talking about earlier. We both met at Sydney Uni, and then we both did a we were both trained as art teachers, and then we both went and did a dip ed, but we didn't really, that wasn't really the area we wanted to do. So I met Leonard, and he was talking about all the Greek names that he met while he was doing, when he was researching his thesis on the Hellenic period. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I started a postgrad diploma in photography, and I was interested in documenting my family. And tragically, my father died just a year later, and I became more obsessed with documenting my relationship to Australia, my Greekness. Mm-hmm. And that's where we decided to combine the history with the photography. And that's when we decided to drive around the country. We'd go to cemetery, and our dates were going to cemeteries. And, wow. Oh, look, here's a Greek name. And very romantic.
People
I still love going to cemeteries.
Couple.
Don't you love going through cemeteries? Is that...
Don't bring up necrophilia, please.
Greek word.
Exactly.
So I think that's when we started doing the work ourselves. It all made sense, and we put an order to it around the country. And here we are, you know, four decades later. What the hell are we going to do with everything now?
And this is all off your own bat as well. No one's behind. Was anyone behind you?
No, not really. We've been lucky to get government grants along the way, but of course they're always small. Like our very first book, Images of Home, Mavrik Senitia, I wanted to look at the effects of migration on Greece itself. We talk about people coming here, but what happened to these villages that were left deserted and destitute? The Australia Council did give me a $5,000 grant to do that. So that was enough back then for Leonard and I to go back and document. We decided to go to Ithaca, Kythera and Kastellorizo, the three main islands that a lot of the early settlers had come from. And we did. We found deserted villages in all of these places. We found letters. We found photographs. People had, the houses had collapsed. So a lot of these documents were left lying on the floors of these houses or even on the walls. People expected to go back and they never did. So we started calling them, you know, social cultural museums, which they were in a way. And we also interviewed a lot of Greek Australians, you know, those people that go back and come back and they're not comfortable in either place. So we interviewed them about what is home, where is home. So that was our very first book, and we were lucky to have a publisher, Hale and Armunga. They specialised in Australian history. That book is what really made that journey, you know, possible, I think, because I think it gave us legitimacy that the project was of value. The book sold out. It's out of print. That was encouraging for them to do their second book, which was more a history book on looking at the Greek Australians throughout the country.
I want to seize on that thing that you were just talking about, walking into a house that's been effectively abandoned. What was that like for you to walk into a place that, you know, fully knowing that these people had left with every intention of coming back, and here it is now completely empty and it's now a time warp?
Goosebumps. Goosebumps. You're there looking, finding personal things. And I've got some photographs of old photos on the wall with the Sydney studio sent back to Greece. You've got little handbags that were just left on the wall. You've got letters from cafes here saying, telling them there's work, come. It was emotional to find that.
Did you end up finding those people in Australia?
In fact, this year or last year? I had the exhibition in Glebe, there was someone there and said, oh, that's my uncle's home. Can, even after all this time, people recognise the house.
And this year with that particular photograph, we did make connections then, but we're still making connections now.
Wow.
That photograph.
It takes a long time. And the beauty these days is we've got Facebook. We've got media that, you know, is instant and people can see it immediately and can comment on it. And so we were able to trace who this little girl in the family photo. The ceiling had gone off this house. There was just a wall and there was this rusty photograph. And the woman in her 50s here said, that's my christening photo.
Wow.
And it was in Ithaca, in Exoye in Ithaca. So,
unbelievable.
See, a lot of that stuff's unpublished. A lot of it's in negative form, in boxes, in our archive. The book was good because people from all from Greece and from here, and even from New Zealand, wrote about, I know who these people that you've got in the photograph are. There was one house that had a map, and it had an outline of Australia.
Oh,
they'd
wow.
penciled in, you know, obviously, this is where they were going to go.
Yeah.
No, it was very emotional. And even... at the moment, I've got an exhibition at Macquarie Uni, not my own work, but it's called Spirit of Place, where artists write about, document something that's important to them. And the thing that started off this exhibition was my grandparents' house. In my grandparents' house, when I first saw that for the first time in the late 1970s, there are photographs of my relatives in Canada, America, us growing up that we hadn't seen, that my father would have sent to his parents. So it's my own family museum within my grandparents' house, which was so moving. And every time we go there, it's like a little pilgrimage to this it's changed now a lot because everyone's sort of pilfered all the photos. But it was such an it's an emotional thing to know that you're growing up here, but there's people over there that that know you more than.
Well, I have to say, I had a similar sort of experience a few years ago when I went to visit family in the US, who I hadn't met before, but you know, instinctively felt, you know, we need to meet up. This was my grandmother's brother, you know, who is well into his 80s and whatnot, and we went to Pittsburgh and went to their house and walked in, and there were all these photos of us in this house. You know, they had this whole other life here that we knew, I mean, you know, knew about through letters or phone calls and all that sort of stuff, and here we are looking at, you know, pictures that I had seen in our own houses as a kid and others that I hadn't. And here they were looking back at us on the other side of the world.
It just makes you feel so special that these people love you, but you don't know them. You don't know your grandparents, or you've met your grandparents for a whole total one, you know, 1 week. If you put together all the hours that you were together, it's quite a sad aspect of migration that I think.
It's also such a powerful thing when you consider the power of photography, and this is what I want to ask you. It is such a powerful way of communicating, and particularly if you have an eye for it, which you obviously do. When did you realize that photography was the way that you wanted to express yourself and be able to tell your stories?
Well, in the 80s, when I was, we really thought I wanted to be an art teacher, so I was always interested in the visual arts. And when I was at Sydney Uni, I joined the photography club, and that's where I learned to process and print my own work. But then in 1983, Macquarie Uni was looking for a photographer. I applied. It was a very entry level, and I got it. So, and that's what really changed everything for me, being in a working as a photographer at a university where I learned so much. And I'm actually, you know, 40 years later still doing a lot of freelance work there. So I think having that position as a photographer, learning and it's photography's changed so much from analog, you know, developing and processing black and white. We did colour, we'd do a whole lot of research type photography. So it made me very attuned to the different types of image making processes.
So how did it actually start for you? Did someone give you a camera and say, just go for it, you know, like a little Pentax or something like that? Or how did it all start?
No, I was always interested in photography. And when I learned to actually develop and print my own, that really, you know, there's always one person in each family, I think, that's the person that likes the photos, that steals them off their mother and keeps them. And that was me.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I just had a fascination for photography from very early on. In that 40 photos book, there's a photograph of me, my father and my sister, and I've got a box brownie over my shoulder. Like, I don't even remember our family having a camera. It would have been, I still don't know who owned it, but it's sort of very a prophetic, I suppose. Yeah. Here I'm a three-year-old holding a little box brownie. So I think it was meant to be.
Do you remember the first photo you took?
Not really.
No?
I wish I had an answer.
Was there a turning point in terms of, you know, you took a photo and someone said to you, that's amazing, or that tells a story, or really resonated with someone, and that's when you thought, yep, this is what I want to be doing.
Oh, just photographing my family and then being able to print them myself. I think that's what I love the process of being in the dark room and watching this image emerge.
Yeah,
I think that's it's still magic, you know, the old-fashioned way of printing a photograph. It's obviously much easier now being digital, but I just watching it emerge in the dark room.
Yeah. It might seem a silly question in some respects, but, you know, given your cultural background, but why the Greek diaspora in particular? You've spent most of your life taking photos of the experience here. What made you think that this is a story that I need to tell and help tell better?
Well, no one was doing it. I was pissed off, really, because I was doing a postgraduate diploma. At the time, Greeks were seen as a folkloric stereotype. Whenever Greeks were documented, we were either wearing our national dress, we were either in cafes and milk bars, which, okay, there were a lot. We were either, the other one is the black-clad widow, you know, like the strong stereotypes, and I wanted to veer away from that. We were that, but so much more. And that's why when I combined with Leonard and the history, we were able to tell a richer, bigger, deeper story. And it hadn't been done before. And I think people, when we started having exhibitions, people could relate to it. They saw themselves in the photographs. That's what does it too. Yeah. When people love what you do, you love it more too, because you think you're doing something that's worthwhile. Our jobs were mostly to support this private work that we were doing, like, you know, could have done photography and been more of a commercial-minded photographer and, you know, had a better car than a Toyota, but this is what we chose. So Len and I love going into someone's home and getting the story of someone. It's priceless.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
definitely.
And Leonard, obviously the work you do is crucial for the context of what, in terms of the presentation of some of Effie's work, but I'm guessing it's much more than that as well. Can you explain what the partnership between you two looks like when it comes to collaborating?
Oh, we fight a lot, if I can.
She always wins.
That's not what I was looking for. But
get that out. Get it out of the way.
A little bit of context. Both of us, as we've touched on, but a little bit more here. Both of us have got a background in fine arts and we've got a background in history. Mm-hmm. I went off into the history area. Effie went off into the visual area for postgraduate studies and I did history postgraduate studies.
So it's the perfect partnership.
Yeah,
you've covered both sides.
It is in terms of bringing those ideas that we had, that which we were formulating together. For me, the reason why I joined up with Effie was not only the fact that she allured me in terms of I liked her as a person.
Yeah.
Okay.
That helps.
It does. It does help. Well, I was struggling with my own demons in that I was studying Australian history. I had some great lecturers for postgrad. But there was one academic who one day took me aside, saw that I had potential in that area, and said, "Look, Leonard, if you want to become a professional Australian historian, forget all this WOG stuff, forget this Dago stuff, go off and do research in Great Britain and you'll come here, you'll come back here and you'll have a position," and so on. That infuriated me, particularly given my background, which is quite diverse in terms of its cultural heritage. Yet, so I meant nothing other than replicating a British colonialist, imperialist viewpoint. Well, sorry, that just was not me. I wasn't going to do that. And Australia was much more than that from First Nations onwards. Mm. So it became a political quest for me. The other problem that I saw, given the fine arts background that we both had, was that historians tended to look at, in this country, literary documentation. Mm. That's limited. If you take a look at images, historical images, you can get information from them which you won't necessarily find in the written documentation. And then when you get information from the visual and go back to the literary, you start seeing the literary in a different way. Mm-hmm. And what emerges from it is a somewhat different story to what you previously thought you were reading. And that's what happened with the work that we're doing. So the visual, as well as the literary, became an important marriage that it had to communicate and talk to one another. And then, of course, the third party was to go and absorb memories from individuals. Of course, memory is flawed, just like any written document can be flawed, official or non-official. But you have to navigate your way through an individual's memory. I'm sure you guys are experienced at it. And you have to ensure that you get a balance. We weren't simply interested in middle-class perspectives. Oh, yes, I've made it. I'm very successful. And take a look at my fleet of ships. That's part of the story, but diversity was important. So we wanted to get, as I said earlier, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We wanted to have a cross-section of the community so that we get their perspectives, and their perspectives not simply on their lives, but their interrelationships with the other groups that they interacted with and what resulted from it, and their experiences from lands beyond where they had finally settled, to see how it all comes together. Because really, the story of humanity is global. Mm. We're all interconnected. And when my brother, for instance, did his DNA and said, "Oh, this is really fascinating. Did you know that we from here, there, and the other?" And I said to him, "Paul, listen, the end game here is that you'll realise we're all interconnected, black, white, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're all interconnected. And we all have stories that we can share and tell. And that's what history should be bringing out." Anyway, it was wonderful to have met Effie on the project. I remember I was shelving books during postgraduate days, trying to get some extra money. I knew that Effie had gone off to Greece because we knew each other during the undergraduate period. And I was standing in Fisher Library at the borrowing desk talking to a colleague. And I felt this presence behind me. I turned around and there's Effie.
This Greek goddess, he says.
That was so important because that's when she said, "Oh, I've just come back from Greece and I've discovered these wonderful things, these abandoned houses on Amkithera. And do you know anything about Greek migration and settlement?
That was interesting. I stayed with his family and I'd go out walking during the day, and it was on Kithera, and this whole street of abandoned houses. And I hadn't, it's an area that hadn't been done before. No one had thought about documenting them. Yeah. And that's why it took another 5 years after that to actually get the funding to go back and to go to Ithaca and Kastellorizo as well when we did that. So it was great having, like, we're a partnership.
Yeah.
And
so it's
a great partnership. We work,
and it wasn't just for Greeks. We're not doing this for Greeks. It's Australian history, and I always emphasise that. When we have our exhibitions, it isn't just for Greeks. We emphasise Australian history. They're human stories. And that's what I think a lot of the Greek organisations tend to just focus in on their own. I think you've got to expand it out a little bit. It's part of who we are here.
Mm. Can I just ask, just on that, did you touch on mainland at all? Was it just Kithera?
Yes.
Did you end up in Ipiro at all, by any chance?
We haven't been up north much.
Okay. Not in Ipiro. Even my family come from villages where have been abandoned from the 1950s.
Because of migration.
Yeah, definitely.
Has it changed now?
I believe families are going back just for the summer and building the houses that have collapsed.
Oh, yeah. When you mentioned that building, rebuilding the houses, that's unfortunately the villages that we documented when we were in Greece twice, documenting these abandoned villages. Because of the renewal, because of the succeeding generations that have gone back with some money, they have actually, to some extent, destroyed the heritage which was still lying there. Yeah. Oh, it's scupidia. It's rubbish. Yeah. Just throw it out.
Yeah.
When we did historical archaeological digs, we've got maps of where things were found, in which home, and where these homes were in terms of the cobbled pathways. We've got maps that no longer apply to the villages as they have been rebuilt. So they become part of the historical transcript that we've created.
Well, the second generation's gone back, obviously, and been able to,
to restore
fix them up. But we documented a period that was as it was at that time, which I think has changed, but it's good to have a record of it.
Do you hear stories of Greeks going back there to do that sort of thing and cringe and just be like, oh shit, we're going to lose, you know, potentially lose stories here?
In a way, but it's their own history that they're destroying, so...
I love it when they say, look what I've done, I've preserved this for my papoon. What about the photographs that were in it? Could you preserve them?
Because we have the same sort of anxieties, because we've got properties over there and whatnot, and it's always the question of how much of the original do you leave versus what you take out, because there's stories in the dust that's, you know, that's on all of these things, isn't there?
Well, there's a photograph that Effie took of a wedding. It was a wedding photograph, and it had been etched onto the glass. It was on the floor of this abandoned home. I think it was Kithera. Effie documented it because we knew that as soon as we attempted to separate the photograph from the glass itself, very little would
this
remain.
This wedding photo had been exposed to the elements for I don't know how many years, and it was just very fragile, lying on the ground. And so I took a photo of it. So that's it doesn't matter if it disintegrated. It was inevitable that it would disintegrate. But
did you end up getting their names?
A lot of these houses, they were, some of the houses were abandoned from the 20s, 30s onwards. So some of them were really quite old.
Those homes that did have letters going back, then we knew the family names and so on, and so we could follow the potential trail within Australia. But any homes that didn't have letters or documents of some form that had been preserved, that became a problem. But other things that we found, for instance, with those Greeks who went back from the gold rushes, what about on Ithaca? On Ithaca in Phrygis, there was a gentleman whose forebears...
Alexandratos,
whose forebears had been to the Russias. Some members of the family had remained in Australia. One became a very well-established architect in Melbourne, but his forebears, his direct forebears, had gone back to Ithaca. And when we walked into the house, there were images...
He had portraits from Ballarat and Bendigo on the walls.
Oh, wow.
He had bank books. He had little gold nuggets. And the problem was he was deaf. So we couldn't communicate, but he was all excited that we were interested in the Australian collection that he had. So we were able to document it and able to work out a story. And we ended up meeting his relatives. They're Melbourne based, So we got the story that the family had gone back. Matt did well in Ballarat Bendigo, gone back. He was one of the brothers that remained and looked after the... God knows what's happened to it now. Yeah. But see, like history changes too. Like we'd love to go around Australia again or follow a lot of these stories up to see what has happened, transpired over that time.
Another interesting story, which Effie couldn't be part of because he wasn't permitted on the peninsula, Athos.
Yes,
during the gold rushes, we actually had monks out here from Athos who were looking for, finance to rebuild their monasteries. And their monasteries are essentially huge fortresses which had their own armory, which had their own treasuries. And Michael Karras, who was a filmmaker who joined us, he did a documentary, an SBS documentary on the project back in 1988, where he came along with us. And he actually documented quite a lot of our stories. We went to Athos looking to see whether or not anything had been brought back. And there was one particular monastery, and the name of the monastery has escaped me right now, but we were permitted to go into the treasury. After a while, you have to speak to the abbot, and the abbot has to become familiar with you, and particularly since I'm not Orthodox, but I was trusted. And we found gold nuggets that had been labelled in iron ink that they had come from the Victorian fields.
Wow. Yeah.
So there's another Australian gold rush connection with Greece, I suppose.
Unbelievable. Man has gold mined in Australia.
Small nuggets, yes. Yeah, we don't know how much had been brought back. These treasuries are phenomenal. They are great cultural institutions, collections of a variety of the meetings of various cultures from across the globe.
And maybe you two should go to Mount Athos.
If you can get into the treasuries and have a look with respect, definitely. It is phenomenal what they have from east and west.
Yeah.
Even though there was an exhibition in the, during the 1990s, the treasuries were opened up and selections were made and an exhibition was held throughout Greece. It's nothing in comparison to when you go and see what they actually have. It's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal.
Sounds like a museum.
Very, very much so. If you're interested in parchment documents, vellum documents, if you're interested in jewellery with a variety of influences that shows the cross-cultural influences from east and west, armoury from knights... It's just mind-boggling, absolutely mind-boggling. And, of course, you're within a monastery that was built over some 1,000 years old. The frescoes, I remember there was one... We had to follow Byzantine time, which means that you get up at 2 o'clock and you've got to go to the early service, and Michael was very devout, and... I'm just looking at the frescoes and analysing them because of our fine arts background, and I spent 2 to 3 hours whilst the services were going on just talking to myself. My goodness, that's amazing. And there was one stage where I thought I was talking to Michael, but Michael was in the Holy of Holies on the floor praying. But it was a fascinating, fascinating journey.
What an experience.
Did you take photos of all the frescoes and...
No, you have to get permission to take photographs. We did interview a number of monks, some of which were very open.
About how many monasteries are there in Mount Athos?
I'm not the expert on it, but are there 20? And there's also Skeets, where you have a collection of 1, 2, or 3, and then you do have those who live in isolation. Mm. We only targeted 3, 2 of which we knew had connections to Australia, either through the gold rush or because one of the early metropolitans had been there. Mm. We weren't there for an extended period of time. We were there until we felt that we got what we wanted. But I came back and I told Effie, I had one of the most peaceful times in my life there. I'm not joking. You knew exactly what you had to do. You were well fed. As long as you follow the rules, a plate would be left for you. And it was wonderful to talk to a diversity of people from around the globe. It's not just simply, of course, they're not just simply Greek monasteries. You have Russian monasteries there, for instance. And you have people who have come from different walks of life, corporate enterprise, people who, for instance, some were agriculturalists. And you get their worldview perspectives, and they don't try to push anything down your throat. And some of the interviews were very open indeed.
It's interesting you mentioned how you felt when you got back as well. My Betharo actually goes, my father-in-law goes periodically, and he has the same sort of experience. He loves going there. So maybe we should definitely go at some point.
100%.
Go interview the Greek Australians then.
Yeah, they're right. And we interviewed Greek Australians.
I've heard that they're really.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's also, when we were there in the 90s, there was also a monk who was in one of the monasteries whose wife and daughter were in the nunnery on the middle peninsula. Of the Macedonian Peninsula. Fascinating reasons why they're there.
Love to go. And do we need a beard to get in there? Or
two days and you're there.
2 days and you'll have a beard.
Yeah.
That's what the joke
was. That's what I mean. It's a Greek
thing. Classic. Not just Greek, believe me.
We're starting to get a little bit of white.
I'm totally white. Yeah.
Fantastic. So let's look at least one of the projects that you guys have worked on. I wanted to talk about the milk bars a little bit, because I think it's safe to say if you have Greek ancestry and you're in Australia, one of your relatives, or, you know, a papu or a father or someone will have either worked at a milk bar or owned one. My grandfather was no exception. But to start off, for those outside Australia who don't know, what was a milk bar and why did you decide to document them?
A milk bar was a product essentially from a gentleman called Mick Adams, Joachim Tavlaridis was his Greek name. Now, this goes back to the idea of absorbing ideas from where you've had experience in different lands. Now, he had known that in Greece there was the Galactopolion, which is a place that sells milk products, okay, solely milk products. That was in the back of his head. He'd also experienced the soda parlor in the United States and in prior
the drugstore.
The drugstore, soda parlor. Correct.
You'd go there to drink your medicine. Whip up a soda for you. Mm.
And he'd also seen the Hamilton Beach milkshake maker.
Sorry, can I just say, what a drugstore is where you go, you get your medicine like a chemist.
Yeah, it was called a drugstore soda parlour. So they had the soda machine there with the drugstore. So if you needed to take medicine, you had to sweeten it up a bit. So
it was so disgusting.
It was so bad. So that's where the drugstore soda parlour idea came from, with the aerated drinks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It sold other products, and it was also a place of communication. It sold papers, it sold lollies, it sold sweets, and so
on. Mick Adams had a cafe at the Haymarket area during the Depression. Mm. During the Depression, a lot of people went bankrupt. He had money left over. He decided to go to Greece, see his relatives, and then the US, visit his relatives. And this is where the two ideas combined, the Galactopolion and the drugstore soda parlour. So when he came back to Australia, he thought, okay, the recession, this is too expensive, I can't have as many waitresses. So he built the black and white milk bar in Martin Place in 1932, and it was called the Milk Bar.
Was that one of the first ones in Australia?
The very first one, globally. It was a global enterprise.
Wow. Yeah, look, the term milk bar had been around, okay, but he developed the modern concept of the milk bar. And the modern concept was that you do not have any table service. You do not provide any food. You fixate essentially on milkshakes. Mm. He still did have sodas, but the milkshakes were different to what we had today. The milkshakes today are actually a product of the 1950s, which are full of saturated fats and sugars. The milkshake that he provided was a health drink. Right. And milk was being elevated by politicians, by the state, as good for your health.
And the milk board. It was very popular to drink milk.
To put it in the context of today, it might have been a kombucha store or something like that.
Yeah.
Or a juice bar.
Sure.
Look, he was very popular on the first day of opening. He had 5,000 people, and Martin Place had vehicle traffic in it at the time, and police were called in to divert vehicle traffic. In the first week, there were 27,000 people who came in, within five years, there were thousands upon thousands of milk bars across the country. Mm. Incredibly popular. And then there was a knock-on effect to New Zealand, where Greeks who had seen its popularity here took it over to New Zealand and established black and white milk bars in New Zealand. It then went across to South Africa. It went across to South Pacific Islands. A British Australian took it across to Great Britain and established milk bars in Great Britain and also on the continent. And he established one allegedly underneath the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
Wow.
So really, it was a global phenomena. Now, Did it get into the United States? There were attempts after World War II to get into the United States, but it failed because of the iconic nature of the drugstore soda parlor. The United States, no, very, very difficult. And the other thing that I'll bring up here is we actually influenced the development of milkshakes in the US. They were not popular in the US. Milkshakes have been around since the 1880s. And as the name suggests, it was something that was handshaken.
Yep.
Okay? And it wasn't until the Hamilton Beach milkshake maker, which actually was developed to mix malt with milk, not create milkshakes, that which is what Adams had seen and said, hang on, I could produce milkshake concoctions really fast and I don't need many staff and so on. During World War II, with the Americans coming out here, they went to the Greek cafes, to the Greek milk bars, and they found a little piece of America because you had aspects of American culture in there.
Yeah.
And then they saw the milkshake. And then, of course, you also had these Yanks, some of whom married Australian girls and took them off to the United States. And when you take a look at the rise of milk at consumption in the US in particular areas and what that milk was being consumed as, it was the rise of the milkshake in the United States during the 1940s. And so when people see the situation comedy Happy Days, which was set in the 1970s, which was set in the 1950s, but it was on television during the 1970s. Yep. In actual fact, there's a link to Australia because the milkshake's popularity in the 1950s arguably is because of the influence of the Americans who were out here in Australia looking at the milkshakes.
Jeez. But that's just the milk bar. It's not, the Greek cafes were already in existence throughout Australia, the Greek cafes.
The Greek cafes were before the milk bar.
Yes, Greek cafes were before the milk bar, and they developed from the Oyster Saloon. You know, the Oyster Saloon was the very British...
Explain what that is.
You do it, Leonard.
Okay. I mentioned earlier that Greeks had been food caterers on the gold rush fields.
Sure.
Okay. And they were providing food, variety of services to the gold miners. From that, when they decided to go into the cities, the major coastal cities, they found the British-style oyster saloons. Now, in Britain, oyster saloons were a working-class male, okay? Eating in Great Britain was stratified according to what social level you were at. So these were working-class establishments. If you were well-to-do, fine dining, you'd go French. We had the same thing replicated out here and initially in the United States before the Greeks got to them. Mm. Greek eating traditionally is far more inclusive. Hey, Yanni, come on down. Bring Papu. Bring Theo down too. Everybody. Bring Yaya. It's the taverna experience. Okay. So the stratification went out the door, both in the US with the Greek influence and within Australia. So when they went into the oyster saloons, they diversified their clientele. They also diversified what they were providing, not just simply oysters, but they provided red meat, variety of fish, they provided alcohol as well as soft drinks, and they then started introducing American-style ice cream, which was very sweet on the palate. The type of ice cream here in Australia, early part of the 20th century, wasn't sweet.
Right.
I can guarantee that because we've interviewed people, because we've been doing this for so long, who tried Australian-made ice cream then. And Peter's, for instance, Peter's ice cream was by an American who originally was fixing push bikes and then had seen the success of American-style ice cream produced within the Greek cafes by the Greeks and thought, that's a great idea, I'll get onto that, and hence you know what happened.
Wow, Peter's ice cream.
And also American-style chocolates, which again were incredibly sweet, and the psychology of packaging of chocolates. If I provide you with something that is in a glossy package with a bow around it, it becomes something special, intriguing, inviting. It's a surprise, a present, and so on. The Greeks brought all of that over here with them from the United States within the Greek cafes, but originally in the oyster saloons, which they transformed. And the oyster saloons then became soda sundae parlours and cafes.
Wow. So they used to serve oysters initially. And then
it was very popular. Oyster saloons were a very working class British food. They're very high protein, I suppose. They're very good for you.
Wow.
The Thames apparently got fished out of the oysters.
And so did Sydney Harbour. Period,
and Sydney Harbour.
We had oysters in Sydney Harbour.
Very popular oyster saloons.
Rock oysters. Yeah. Rock oysters. Okay. And of course, there's the famous story about the Commonos in regard to their diversification, not simply being able to retail oysters and other products within their outlets, but also then going into oyster farming. and being very successful at it. And they had oyster farms on the north coast of New South Wales as well as the south coast of New South Wales. So they were the primary providers, as well as the distributors, as well as being able to retail it. So we have entrepreneurialism taking hold here within the Greek genre of food catering.
Wow. Mm.
So in the 80s, when we started driving around the country looking for them, of course, we were able to catch quite a few, but a lot of them had disappeared. Like the heyday was the, you know, the 50s, the 60s. Every country town had one. Some had 10 of them. Like some country towns like Wagga had 10. Family could work together. They were very successful for the Greeks.
When did this transition to the old-fashioned fish and chip shop?
That's what I was going to say.
Was there a transition, or when did the fish and chip shop come to
Okay, fish and chip shops introduced from Great Britain.
Okay.
And arguably, for instance, if we go back to Komono, he acquired a fish and chip shop, which
Who
he went
Komono
into.
Who was Komono again?
There were two brothers, Athanasios and John Komono.
They did the very...
Emmanuel Komono.
Okay. So a very common name. But they, the two brothers did that very first book, The Greeks in Australia, published in 1916. I'm not sure if you've ever seen that. It's in Greek and it's been recently transcribed into English. It was more like an advertisement. They sent 5,000 copies to Greece, to Kythera mostly, to entice them to come here, look at
Emmanuel's
the opportunities.
Emmanuel's got to be connected to these guys.
Well, he
sure
would be. You know Emmanuel Komono from the...
The
Parthenon.
Yes.
He would be connected.
The
sure.
connected one is John Komono, who was mayor of Waverley at one time.
Okay.
He's the son of, grandson.
Interesting.
But the Komono name became so associated with oyster saloons at the early part of the latter part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, that other Greeks took on the name, even though they themselves were not necessarily Kytherian or not necessarily of the Komono clan, because of the association with their Komono and good food catering that could be provided by them.
So we've got hundreds of stories. So in that book that we published in 2016, it was more to promote the Americanization aspect that we were interested in. But we're actually planning to do a volume two with just to publish some of the stories that we've got in boxes to get them out there.
So you're saying Greeks left Greece, went to the US. Were they born in the US?
Or some were, yes.
Some were.
And then they came to Australia.
Yep.
There were more opportunities as well. You know, after a lot of opportunities got exhausted in the US, or they had relatives. Some had shops there, some had shops here.
Yeah, there was a direct connection, even with the Komonos, for instance. There was another publication similar to the 1916 book that Effie referred to that was produced in California called The Greeks in California. And in that, you have evidence of the Komonos.
That was
having
published in
1917. Of the Komonos having shops in California, that extended clan, and then having come over and worked in shops over here. Look, with the Greeks in the United States...
What era are we talking about?
We're talking about the 1910s.
Hence the names, the Niagara, the Astoria, the Monterey.
See, what the Greeks were responsible for, if I could digress a little bit, when they started affecting popular culture in Australia through their food catering prowess, and it's associated with cinema and popular music and architecture and so on, they were part responsible for the transference of the cultural vision of British Australians who were here away from Great Britain across to the United States. And that's a very powerful thing to do. It's a very powerful thing that you're a migrant settler and you have had this effect unknowingly on the cultural psyche and the cultural knowledge that the population is acquiring. Now, mind you, there are other aspects in terms of our military relationship and in terms of our economic relationship, but certainly in terms of the cultural prowess, the Greeks are essential.
It is an amazing legacy, isn't it? And it's something that everyone, that all of us here have some kind of a connection to. I think that's the thing that's so powerful.
And what's wonderful, it's called the Greek Cafe because it's the Greeks that ran them, not because they served Greek food or they did not do that till much later. So it was all British food that they were serving, you know, the mixed grills and everything.
It was the Greeks who brought out the front service soda fountain in the drugstore soda parlours. Originally, the soda fountain was a back service soda fountain because they hadn't developed the technology to push the liquid and gas great distances. But when that had developed, they were the first ones to have it in their shops in the United States, and then they brought it out here. And in terms of the economic relationship to the US, from Newcastle, we were exporting coal in the early part of the 20th century, this is the 1910s, to the US. But what we were getting in terms of the transference, Greeks were coming out to Newcastle, and one of the very first front service soda fountains was in Newcastle in a cafe that was then called the Niagara Cafe.
Wow.
Well, it was a massive port. You could argue that it was a global port of its time in terms of the amount that it was exporting goods across to the US, but particularly coal. But in return, we were getting Greeks with these ideas. So the Greeks went across the United States, manifest destiny. There's Australia across the Pacific. What can I do there?
Yeah. It's the beginning of globalization, really.
Yeah, it is. Well, the Greeks have been highly globalized because
it's
of their migrations.
Said earlier, yeah. Absolutely. Before we wrap it all up, let's look at the books that are coming out now. Obviously, there are two. One's, Effie, I think you were saying, is already out, and there's another one in the pipeline.
Well, the
right
40
now.
Photos, 40 photographs a year at a time. I did this year to celebrate 40 years of documenting, so I chose one photograph per each year. So that was a bit of a challenge, and it actually starts off in 1982 with my parents in. We had a fish shop, in our fish shop. So,
so did we. It's a common thing.
And so,
I grew up in a fish shop.
Yeah. Did you like it?
I remember I love chips.
So. I thought you were going to say chips. It was all fishy.
I was really young. I was a really tubby kid, and it was probably all the potatoes I've been eating.
I hated it, and every time I saw a school friend, I just wanted to disappear or hide. It's a different time growing up, wasn't it?
Yeah, my brother and sister would definitely have good memories of it, but I remember the stories I heard was just Mum would be working the whole time and Dad would be working. Dad would be at the fish market grabbing the fish, Mum would be peeling potatoes, and kids would get dropped off at school and I'd just sit, you know, in front of the TV eating potatoes.
And I love the scallops too.
That's my childhood.
I know, but it was tough work, and seeing your parents work so hard, because the fish markets, I did go with my father a few times, and I always found that a bit challenging.
The array of smells.
The smells, and they'd go up close and look at all the buckets, turn the fish around, and I couldn't. It was an auction system, and I really couldn't get it. And they were all Greek, and they all loved the. It was a real camaraderie. It was like another Kafanur, but it was a big fish market. They all. It was a male bonding.
Evangeli sardella simera.
That's right.
Apparently, they look at the eyes of the fish. That's how they tell
the glossy,
how fresh they are.
Yeah, I still do that now. I think. Although, who buys fish heads? You don't, do you? You have cutlets or fillets.
No. Only for soup. For soup. Soup, we still do that.
Yeah. Leonard makes fun because I like the fish eye. Because it's chewy and...
So that starts off
with that. It's more of a personal book. I've avoided interviewing my own family with all of these books because you want to keep a distance.
Sure.
And so, but this one's more personal. It starts off with that, and then it ends off... The last photo is of my mother, you know, holding her post-COVID. It was a really tough time. 22 people are sort of stuck at home.
Yeah.
Made it more immobile. She uses a walker. So it was just sort of a very personal reflection of the 40 years that I've been doing this. It includes interviews that we've done with people through Leonard's great interviewing skills. And it's also a comment. I make a comment now, looking back on a lot of these photos, from 20, 30, 40 years ago, like my impressions now of that image. And I think that's binds the time together. And the other book that I've just got a draft copy of the other day, which is very exciting. The last few years I've spent at the soup kitchen of Father Nectarios in Newtown and sort of interviewed all the helpers, Father himself, people that use the facility there. Mm. He's been helping the homeless for so many years. He was the
Amazing
first
story.
That instigated a lot of the food initiatives that I think the church does today. Yeah. And they all acknowledge him
Definitely.
Having done that.
All my first memories as a kid, I'd see all these homeless people congregating around the Greek church, and I wouldn't know what was going on. Are they Orthodox? But no, he'd be feeding them after the service. And
he's amazing.
Very amazing, inspirational person, what he did.
Yeah, so...
That'd be interesting. So that's a book you've got. Is it photos and interviews?
It's photos and interviews. Yeah. I did this one myself without Leonard. I'd go there once a week, sometimes twice or three times with the iPhone. The iPhone's fantastic. You'd go up to a lady, get someone's story.
Is he still there by any chance?
He's retired. I visited him at home, but he goes in there sometimes. The cover of the book has was St. Nectarios Day, and I'll show it to you in a minute. It's quite, lovely photo, and it's called The Heart of Giving, Father Nectarios Soup Kitchen. And so that's coming out later in the year. It's on the slow boat from China at the moment. that's more personal again, and I'm very excited about that because it's a lot of the people working, like our mothers and younger, that have been on the journey with Father Nectarios, and sometimes it's really interesting to see the homeless mixing in with this, first-generation Greek women that are very bossy and, sometimes these people need medication, they're a bit aggro, how they deal with them. And it's just, it's a very inspiring place. Father Stavropoulos now runs the soup kitchen. Wow. Yeah, so I've documented a lot of the bishops too that were christened by Father Nectarios. So it's more than the soup kitchen. It's the environment around that.
Yeah. It's an amazing story, and we can't wait to see the book. I mean, what a discussion this has been. This has gone to places that I really didn't think it was going to go. You guys have a very unique partnership here that I think it's benefiting our community, not only here in Australia, but obviously the Greek diaspora abroad. Thank you so much for coming here. Thank you so much for giving us your insight. We're so proud to have had you here. Nick, mate, any final thoughts?
Just one last question. There's so many photos out there that we've all got in our photo albums, and that generation now is passing on. What's your advice or recommendation you can give our audiences out there? Because
get them off your phone so that you don't lose your phone and don't.
Well, they're
lose
not even
them
on the phone. They're in these photo albums that are turning yellow with plastic all over them.
Take that plastic off, and if you can, get them digitized as well so that the family can share them.
Great question.
Get the information on them. Get the important thing is how many times do you wish you've asked someone who is that person in the photograph? You really you need to ask those questions now and document it and keep it filed away for your children and your grandchildren.
Print them off, digitize them, put them on an external hard drive.
Get them out
somewhere.
Of the plastic sticky stuff that
but they might ruin them. Though so I've got a that, few I started to look at them now.
Just take the plastic off the top anyway because
is it worth
it yellows
taking a
them.
Photo with your phone?
Yes, if you've got a larger format camera it's better to get a higher resolution.
If I could just add there, we don't collect original images. There's a philosophical reason for that, as well as a financial one. We could not afford to preserve them. The easiest way that you could preserve photographs is to use acid-free paper that you can get over at a news agency, for instance, and make sure that you don't touch it with your hands. You've got oils and fats and acids on your fingers, okay? And every time you touch the image, it'll deteriorate. You also find that in the 1970s with the use of chemical colour, which was only
like
on the surface.
Polaroid ones, they disappear. So it's best to document them while you can still see them.
Yeah. When Effie has exhibitions, she usually prints on archival paper, which means that the image goes through the paper, not just simply on the surface. Right. So it'll last at least 100 years. You'll find that the Holtermann collection, for instance, which is the oldest documentary collection, that's lasted because it's on glass plate and eggs. But then when you have people who are printing on archival paper in the later part of the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, those images have remained strong and good. Sometimes the silver, which is in the composition of the photograph, will come out and you'll get a shiny surface.
Yeah.
But the image, unlike the 1970s, is still there. The other thing in regard to the philosophy of when you take a photograph from someone and you don't give them a copy, the memory within the family changes and the journey of that photograph is no longer with them. So it cannot develop new memories. When you put a photograph in the public sphere, it acquires new experiences and new memory, which is public, because you bring your experiences to it. When we have exhibitions, the whole idea is not to pontificate. It's to give a suggestive experience that someone can add to, or someone can contradict by an experience that they've had, which is different to the experience that you're putting. So when it comes to people saying, what should we do with those images? They should make a decision if they want to give it to a public institution. Make sure that public institution has the facilities to not only preserve the original, but make a copy of it accessible for researchers via digital. If they can't,
I know the State Library, there's some people that have been in touch with us. What do we do with this archive if they're original and you can't look after them anymore, if they're very special? The State Library may be interested in keeping originals, which that they're interested in doing.
But you've got to get a copy. You've got to get a copy.
For the family.
Okay. Because, there's so many families out there, and people are passing on now. We've got these old photo albums. And I've seen so many people in an attic and they've never seen
them. They disappear, don't they?
And then people pass on and then people just see it as junk.
It's
very important. But anyway, look, that's fantastic. It's been a great, great listening and learning experience for me, just listening to you guys. And I can relate a lot of my family, my history through what you're saying as well. So we've grew up in fish and chip shops and being to some of these places that you talked about, like derelict villages, that's my parents' village.
So the next time that we have a discussion with you, either in public or in private, I'm going to ask both of you, how much have you two documented now?
Homework.
Well, I've definitely already started mine. There's quite an extensive archive on my end. We're quite fortunate in my family. There's a lot of photographers and there's a lot of... There have been steps taken to, you know, to sort of archive a lot of this stuff. So we're half a step ahead so far.
Yeah,
could always be better.
I'm way behind.
But that's a great last question. A fantastic way to end this all. Guys, thank you so much for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure, as I said. Where can people find your work online? Is there a website that we can find you on?
www.cafesandmilkbars.com.au.
Fantastic. Get in touch there on the website. And Nick, uzotalkatoutlook.com is the email. Make sure you're following us there. Send us your feedback. Send us your email. Send us your thoughts. Follow us on social media at uzotalk and at uzo_talk on most social media platforms.
Perfect.
Nick Athanasiou, thank you very much, mate.
Thank you, Tom. Awesome. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.